It's Australia Day today. Happy Australia Day to you all. A day for public holidays and barbecues and celebrations and, well, a whole lot of navel-gazing, really, about what we are and who we are and what we should be and what we might be. And perhaps interviewing Australians of the Year and that kind of thing. But today I want to do something a little bit different. I want to look at Australia, but through an international lens. What exactly is our role in the world? Are we a player in international affairs? Do we want to be? Should we be? When was the last time we had a conversation publicly about anything that resembled foreign policy, or do we just not do that anymore? Gareth Evans is well-credentialed to discuss this. He was the former Australian Foreign Affairs Minister between 1988 and 1996. He's also President Emeritus of the Brussels-based International Crisis Group. I started by asking him earlier today about the 2010 election campaign, which was marked by an absence of anything that looked vaguely like foreign affairs in the public debate. Was this a sign of where Australia's head is, that we're not really engaged with international affairs?
Yeah, it was really a bit surprising given Kevin Rudd's prominence for, and his personal predilections and personal commitments, but it did just drop off the radar screen and we've become very, very indifferent as a nation to where we stand, how we're perceived. Yet this is extraordinarily important in terms of national interests, however you conceive them broadly or narrowly. And I think it is important to get this stuff back in the public domain. There is a hunger, I think, and an instinct in the Australian public to do this stuff properly, even if it's something they're not particularly concerned or obsessed with. I mean, remember the response to Julia Gillard's first foray into foreign affairs when she said she wasn't really interested in that sort of stuff and would be prepared, much prefer to spend time with...
In schools.
And that there was a sense that this was inappropriate, that a Prime Minister really ought to know how to present and the country effectively and be genuinely committed to this stuff. So I think that the background is there and the people know if you're blowing it and making a mess of your conduct of foreign affairs, but there's not really the kind of passion that one can remember back from the days of, the Vietnam War and all those areas where people's personal interests were very directly and immediately engaged and foreign affairs was the flavour of the month. It's been a long time now since that was so.
Perhaps the Iraq War was maybe the last spike in that. But Julia Gillard, to look at those comments, there was a bit of a backlash, but probably mostly amongst the talking class, probably mostly amongst people who are interested in journalism, for instance, or interested in international affairs. Surely she wouldn't have said something like that if she didn't think that that's actually the kind of message that the Australian electorate was interested in hearing.
Well, it goes back also to Paul Keating's preoccupation with Asia and people's perception that this was going to be unhelpful in terms of the government's re-election. But I think, again, that did touch a bit of a chord. And I think we undervalue and underestimate the degree of potential interest in the Australian public in these issues. And I think we underestimate the degree of understanding there is about how important this stuff is. It's never going to come in over the top of anxiety about jobs and economic future and more immediate social policy issues that are the flavour of the month in domestic debate. Very, very rarely is it going to intrude unless in some very obvious way of a military engagement and lives are being lost and anxiety about terrorism and so on. But I think there is a willingness to get serious about this debate, which a lot of the political class these days and a lot of journalists writing for the public as they perceive them does underestimate. And, people are intelligent. They are perfectly capable of having an intelligent view and an interest about these issues. And that's one of the things I think our political cast ought to be much more sensitive to.
Well, it's not really about intelligence, it's about engagement and interest. I mean, you seem confident that there is that interest in Australia, but what's the evidence for it? What are you drawing on that's allowing you to draw that conclusion?
Well, I'm drawing on the fact that we won an election, which we weren't expected to win, in which the issue of Australia's engagement and Australia's preoccupation with those sort of issues was something that people thought would count against Keating and his government.
But it's a long time ago.
Sophisticated. It's a long time ago, but it was a long time ago that I was directly involved in these things. And, of course, issues like boat people and so on do have a foreign policy dimension to them. There's no doubt about the degree of resonance that's had in the Australian public. All I'm saying is, look, there are better angels in our collective communal nature, both in terms of the values that people bring to the debate of these sorts of delicate issues. And there is a degree of potentially quite engaged, intelligent interest which political leaders and journalists ignore at their peril. And if you trivialise the debate and have it just in, you know, 5-second sound bites or dismissive and contemptuous, talking about the Security Council candidature as a vanity project of Kevin Rudd's, if you use this sort of language, it is sort of self-fulfilling and very unhappy, because certainly not in Australia's interest to have these issues treated in that way. But also I do optimistically believe that it's against the way in which people are prepared to be engaged in these issues if only we treat them to an intelligent debate.
Part of the issue, though, has got to be whether or not these issues are being explained to the Australian public. And I just wonder, I mean, take the Security Council bid for a moment as an example.
Yeah, well, this is a very good example, I think, because this is seen as a preoccupation of Kevin Rudd. It hasn't been given any kind of attention by the rest of the political leadership. In fact, there's a bit of a sort of perception around the town that this is a, you know, a foreign minister's exercise of no larger real interest to the government or the wider community. And certainly so far as the opposition is concerned, we've seen an almost Newt Gingrich-like sort of dismissal of this as, you know, this is just utterly fruitless preoccupation with something that's got nothing to do with anything. And I think the truth of the matter is that the story does need to be told, which is what I tried to do with the Australian Day address today. And what I was trying to say is, look, the Security Council is at the apex of our international peace and security system, directly and immediately impacts on Australian interests, however you conceive them, broadly or narrowly. We've got Australian troops operating under UN mandates in Afghanistan, East Timor. We're committed to apply sanctions policies which are applied by the Security Council. This is at the heart and soul of world affairs. It will be next year 27 years since we've had a seat at that table. And for a country like Australia, which is a serious player in world affairs, this is really a disgraceful abdication of a responsibility, both a responsibility to ourselves and the national interests that are involved to get these decisions made well, but it's also an abdication of our responsibility, I think, to the wider international community to be an effective player in a way that we can be.
You say there that we are a player. I think that perhaps is at the heart of a lot of Australians' disengagement with foreign affairs, this belief that, well, what difference really can and does Australia make in the international arena? Why do you think we're a player?
Well, because of the evidence of my own eyes in terms of the issues that I was involved with, and Kevin Rudd has certainly been involved with, for example, the creation of regional policy architecture to create now, as we've done, this new East Asia summit, as a way of defusing tension between the US and China and avoiding putting ourselves in the position of having to make a horrible zero-sum choice between our biggest economic partner and our traditional security ally. We're a player in terms of the way in which we've helped set the agenda on the critically important issue of nuclear disarmament. This is a very remote and abstract issue for an awful lot of people, but along with climate change, this is the one really big existential anxiety that we ought to have, because only CO2 and nuclear weapons can destroy life on this planet as we know it, and nuclear stuff can do it a hell of a lot faster.
Yeah, absolutely.
And these are issues in which Australia has been a player. I mean,
people. Well, in what way? Expand on that.
Well, I mean, in terms of the nuclear thing, we led an international commission which frankly did do a lot, even though it was largely unacknowledged here, to set the agenda for the specific Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference last year, which kept a lot of flames burning which might otherwise have died in terms of an effective international regime for non-proliferation had that conference been a failure. Going back in time, we were the key players in introducing and bringing to conclusion a chemical weapons convention which actually outlawed some of the most horrible weapons of mass destruction the world has ever seen. But we've been a player in multiple other ways, in multilateral trade negotiations, going back to Keating-Hawke era, the Uruguay round, and subsequently we've been players on issue after issue. The whole question of UN reform, the way peacekeeping is conducted, we are a player and perceived to be a player out there on the ground in the missions that Australians do participate in. And there's something, I think, about the Australian character which makes us, if you can make these generalisations, which makes us very effective peacekeepers, because we do collectively have a a disposition not to either suck up or kick down, which means that, you know, people respond very well in these community situations in godforsaken countries in Africa and elsewhere. So over and over again, I mean, Australia and Australians have been players at the high policy level on big issues like disarmament, proliferation, climate, economic, trade, liberalisation, decision-making, policy-making, architecture. And we've been important players, I think, at a personal level. Individual Australians have a terrific reputation worldwide, and I think we should just build on that.
You're on RN Drive. We'll lead Ali with you. I'm speaking to Gareth Evans, of course, the former Foreign Affairs Minister between 1988 and 1996. He's just given an Australia Day address at the Australian Unity Great Australia Day breakfast, and he's good enough to join me now in the studio. I'm interested in this aspect of Australia as something that is internationally engaged and sort of has an influence. But what I guess I picked up from what you were saying, we have this personality that allows us to engage where we don't, you know, it sounded like you were saying we had a kind of independence. I just wonder if that's actually true. To what extent do we have an independence in foreign policy, given that the inherited history of allying ourselves to Britain and then more recently the United States? Do we really stand up and not suck up, as you put it?
We've been at our best and our most influential when we haven't let that traditional historical influence of Britain or the more recent anxiety about security support and the relationship with the US totally influence our decision making. A classic example was the difference that we made in the last days of the apartheid regime, where the Brits were still, you know, very reluctant in all sorts of ways to move aggressively on that, and Australia did lead the way in developing and introducing an international system of financial sanctions, which ultimately were really very critical in putting the final squeeze on the apartheid government. I'm not talking about trade sanctions, which made us all feel better but weren't really making that much difference because there were so many ways they could be evaded. I'm not talking about cultural and sports boycotts, which made us feel very good but were making no practical difference at all. I'm talking about a really systematic effort to get policy agreement to dry up the flow of funds through the banking system and so on, the sort of stuff that's proving fairly effective in Iran right now. And we did all this in working with Canada and some of the key African countries in a way, even though it was within a Commonwealth framework, but it was on an issue in which the Brits were dragging their heels, and we were very much, you know, taking the lead and demonstrating that we could think and act for ourselves.
Do we still have that reputation? Do we still demonstrate that given the last decade?
I think we do. I mean, Rudd has been a bit of an energizer bunny in the way in which he's got himself engaged in, you know, scores of different issues. But we've been playing ourselves into a lot of different debates. The climate debate, the sustainable development debate, people have been scoffing a bit, but there's no doubt that Australia is a serious player. The current debate that's going on about the best way of utilizing development assistance, Australia is playing itself now into the league of very serious donors and as a very serious contributor to the debate about how that stuff can best be used. We're a serious contributor to the whole debate on regional security and how to balance this, you know, very fascinating potential contest that's developing between our great alliance partner and our great economic partner, China and the US in the region. The relationship that we've had with you know, the ASEAN countries, the relationship going back that I had with Indonesia, with Ali Alatas as a foreign minister, meant that we could and did make between us a huge difference in energizing and the Cambodia peace plan. I'm jumping backwards and forwards between history and the present, but I mean, I think the truth of the matter is that there are a whole bunch of areas in the security area, the economic area, the human rights area, the work that we've been doing on mass atrocities that I've had a bit to do during my crisis group in different days, developing the concept of responsibility to protect. Australia now is out there through the foreign minister and the government as a major player in New York. I was in New York last week, and I know this. Australia hosted a important meeting at which this issue was very seriously debated in the aftermath of Libya, where we're going. So Australia's right in there. And you know, look, we're the 13th biggest economy in the world, the 6th biggest landmass, the 3rd biggest maritime zone. We've got a long track record of engagement in multilateral diplomacy, institutional development, the UN itself going all the way back to Evatt, the regional organisations going back to the Hawke-Keating government period. We've got a an active involvement in major conflict resolution, Cambodia, an active involvement in the world's peacekeeping operations. We're, you know, Solomon Islands, East Timor, things going back to the Howard period, very well done, Australia playing a leadership role and thoroughly deserving the accolades that we had. So all of this stuff, past and present, I mean, demonstrates, I think, that we are players. We've got a lot to be proud of about the way in which we've conducted ourselves, and it is important to take this the next step forward by getting actively engaged on a politically united way with real commitment at the leadership level to things like the Security Council candidacy.
And just finally, if we can just come quickly to Iran.
Yeah.
The sanctions have been announced on Iran. The US, the EU and Australia have jumped on board with this. Do you think we should have any confidence that those sanctions will actually hurt the regime as opposed to the people of Iran?
Well, that's always an issue when you get into generalised economic sanctions like oil embargoes of the kind that are now being imposed, or some of the economic banking sanctions on investment flows of the kind that I was talking about before in relation to South Africa. It's much to be preferred to have targeted sanctions, if you possibly can, that deal directly with leadership, travel and access to their personal wealth and all the rest of that sort of stuff. But sometimes you just have to work with the levers you have. And there's no doubt in my mind that the pressure needs to be ratcheted up again on the Iranian regime because of the evidence that is now abundantly out there that they're engaged in a pretty enthusiastic enterprise to further enrich their uranium and put themselves in a position if they make the decision.
Is this the right pressure?
If they make, well, it's about the only pressure you've got. You've got the diplomatic sort of isolation role that's been played. You've got all sorts of other condemnatory stuff and efforts being made through the IAEA. So, I mean, you've got to live with what you've got. And also, it needs to be remembered that the Revolutionary Guards, who are the most troubling element in the Iranian political firmament, are themselves deeply involved in the economy in all sorts of ways, so that if you put stress and pressure on the economy, you are hurting people in the regime. The trouble with sanctions, of course, is that it's such a broad brush impact. So you won't hear me being in any way unwilling to get very tough on Iran at the moment. What you will hear from me, and I think many others, is concern that this doesn't translate itself into a sort of a mindless determination to go bombing Iran and preemptively just because of a fear of what they might do. My view, and I've been following this issue pretty closely all the years I was in Brussels at Crisis Group, spending time in Iran and talking to Iranian diplomats and others all around the world. And while I'm sceptical about all sorts of things, about the way Iranians conduct themselves and horrified by a lot of their internal policy positions, I for a long time have believed, and I still believe, that they have not made a decision to actually go all the way to nuclear weapons. I think they have made a decision to acquire the capability for that breakout at, say, 6 months' notice or something like that, and they hope thereby to spook, you know, the region and have succeeded in spooking the region and the rest of the world about their longer-term intentions. But there's a whole bunch of reasons, which I can articulate had we the time, why I don't think it's certain at all that they're going to go the extra mile. Not least because I think they believe that if they did actually visibly weaponize, the Israelis would not be able to exercise any kind of restraint. They would see it as an existential threat. But they've also got trouble with Russia and China on a much greater scale than they have now. They're going to have even more trouble with sanctions. They're going to have trouble with others in the region who will move as quickly as they possibly can to build their capability of their own, Saudis in particular. It's a time for cooler heads to prevail, certainly, and for diplomacy to be given yet another chance before we rush to a military solution.
Gareth Evans, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, William.
That's Gareth Evans. You're on RN Drive. We'll lead Ali with you.